started. Thank you so much for coming to our Women We Admire presentation, the latest installment. My name is Margaret Wu. I'm the current chair. I have a few more weeks left in my term. Lena Zatal will be taking over the helm of PacSol effective July 1. So yay, Lena. And I always want to thank Erin and Elisa and the Women We Admire subcommittee for putting these great events together. Hope you all have been enjoying them. Just a couple of logistics for those of you on the phone. Please please do stay on mute so that until the question and answer session so that we can have a quiet conversation here with our speaker. And also want to let you know our next speaker will be August 8th, Yvette Lott. Vice Provost, Chief Outreach Officer for Diversity and Engagement. So make sure you have that in your calendars as well. So without further ado, let me just have a brief introduction of our speakers today. Our speaker is Jenny Kao, who's the Executive Director, Issues Management Policy Analysis and Coordination, otherwise known as IMPACT, here at OP, and a former PacSol member, longtime supporter of our organization. And interviewing her today is also one of our OP friends here, Diane Klein. She's the Director of Media Engagement and Strategy. She's a former journalist and foreign correspondent herself, so I think Jenny's in for it today. here at OP, Diane oversees crisis communication. So as you can imagine, she's been pretty busy, but we appreciate all her work and her taking the time
to be with
us.
That does not mean that Jenny is a hot mess, by the way. Thank you.
Thank you,
Margaret. So I am absolutely tickled to be up here today to help you get to know Jenny Kao a bit better. And through that, I am sure you will come away inspired because Jenny is one cool woman. She is a product of California public education, and she's worked in the public sector and in public higher education for more than two decades. She earned a BA with honors from UC Berkeley in American history with a minor in French literature. And from there, she went on to Princeton, where she received a master's in public affairs. And as Margaret said, she is now chief of staff for the public affairs division and also the founding executive director of IMPACT. And these are two demanding and very high-level positions. And I want to point out that Jenny is doing them simultaneously. So as you know, IMPACT, and this took me a while to remember, IMPACT stands for Issues Management, Policy Analysis, and Coordination. And in other words, that's a very bureaucratic way of describing Jenny herself in a professional sense. She is a juggler, she's an astute analyst, and a master coordinator. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention that she is the queen of rollout plans, which she color codes, you know, taking a cue from the inimitable leader, Seth Grossman. In other words, Jenny does it all while still managing to be kind, thoughtful, and cheerful. And this is certainly not just in a professional sense. Jenny is my colleague, but I'm also honored to have her as a very good friend of mine. So now I would like to ask Jenny herself to speak, after which I will open it up for questions from anybody who might have questions for the hecklers, haranguers, any questions that I did not ask her herself. So, Jenny, I'll start off by noting that you have come a very long way since arriving from Taiwan when you were not quite 5 years old with your sister and your parents to San Francisco, and you did not speak a word of English. Sweet little Jenny did not say any words in English. So if you could just start off by giving us some background about your family and why your family immigrated.
Sure. So when I talk about my family, the first thing that comes to mind, and some of you have heard this already, so excuse me, is that I really won the lotto. You know, you don't get to pick your birth family, but I really won the lotto. So I'm very lucky. Everything that's good in me, I get from them, and everything else is totally on me. So we came, as Diane said, when I was not quite 5 years old, and we came solely for the purpose of education for my sister and me, to get a good, high-quality, affordable education. My parents were both college-educated, but my mom went to a not-so-good school, a a cut above DeVry, but sorry, too soon. But she still has a BA. And my father went to a really good university in Taiwan. At the time, it was the only university, really. It was Taiwan University, or maybe they call it Taiwan National now. And they both come from poor families, but my father was one of seven siblings. So he and his brother got to both go to college because the three older sisters worked to support them. So none of the five girls got to go to college, but my father and his brother did. And to this day, we're really thankful to my aunts for that. So so we came here, and, you know, we were, I guess, middle class in Taiwan. My dad had started out as a mailroom guy. Carlos was supposed to be here, but I don't see him. My buddy, he started out in the mailroom at the new, shiny, brand-new IBM in Taipei. And a woman executive, who was like the COO at the time, saw promise in this young man, and so she picked him out of the mailroom and trained him in sales and marketing. And later, he would come here and have a full career with Big Blue in sales and marketing. My mom was a flight attendant in Taiwan, so that's what they did. We came here, as I said, we were probably lower middle class in Taiwan, and we came here and were instantly poor because they didn't know the language, you know, not the culture. They didn't know how to drive. We did have family here, and that's how most immigrants came at that time, was you had some family who had already established roots here. So we moved here, and my parents each worked two jobs while my sister and I went to school. We were definitely latchkey kids. I learned a lot of my English from Gilligan's Island. And, I'm sorry to say, the Brady Bunch, you know, Three Stooges, all the classics. They didn't have Breaking Bad back then. So my dad worked at an insurance company, and then he also worked for free on the side to with some partners. I mentioned this during Rachel's Women We Admire talk in opening up the first Chinese bookstore in San Francisco, which is called East Wind at the time, still is called East Wind, right there on Stockton and Columbus, at the heart of Chinatown where it meets Italian Town, or Little Italy. And there's now a branch also at Berkeley that's been there for many, many years. So he was very, you know, it was revolutionary at the time to have a Chinese bookstore. So he did that at night. My mom worked wiping tables at a school cafeteria during the day. And then at night and on weekends, she paid bills for a very small business. So, and later she would spend her career at Blue Shield in San Francisco in the bill-paying department, so like the BRICS, the accounts payable. So, you know, how they describe coming here is that it's like you take this old, they're in their 30s, but you take this old tree that has all of its roots established in one particular climate, environment, you know, special type of water, all of that, and you just lift it up, roots and all, and throw it in another land. And that's really, you know, what they did to come here. So many immigrants. I mean, we're not unique in that story. And really, as I said, it was just for Kathy's and my education. And education was just always ingrained in us. I don't remember ever hearing them say, you better study hard, education is important. They never said it, but it was just ingrained in me, and I never, you know, thought for once that I wouldn't go to college, for example. And, you know, work ethic is something that I really, really owe to them. My parents both worked really hard, and to the point where I was such a nerd, you guys. Oh, my God. In middle school and high school, I remember just, like, setting the record for never taking any sick days. So because I didn't want to miss any class, and I didn't want to, you know, be late on homework. So that's really sort of a glimpse into my parents. I'll just end with one small story about work ethic, which also tells you a little bit about my current personal issues or personal life right now. But so on March 15th, you know, almost 3 months ago, we knew that my mom had cancer, but we didn't know the extent of it. We didn't know what kind it was. So my dad, my sister, and I went with her to her first oncology appointment. And he said, you have stage 4 ovarian cancer. And so, you know, shocking, of course. And I was the note taker. And anyway, so after, I had taken the afternoon off because I had very, very supportive colleagues and a wonderful boss, Julie, who's here. And so right after the appointment, which was around 3:30, you know, we were kind of in obviously we were all in shock and dealing with it in our own ways. And my mom and dad almost simultaneously said to me, you better get back to work. You better get back to work. And I said, no, I took the afternoon off. And they're like, but there's so much going on. You've been talking about the state audit, and, you know, we've been reading things about the Davis Chancellor, and I just, so anyways, maybe to a fault, but that's where I get my work ethic from.
And how did you end up going to Cal? You know, you were a local girl, and right there, was there any thought of going elsewhere?
Oh, yeah. I was in love with New York City. I had no idea why. But I was sure that I would go to Columbia. I went to visit during the college. I brought all my applications with me, did them all while I was in New York City visiting a friend, and, you know, stayed with her sister in the dorms on, like, you know, 118th Street or something. It just completely fascinated me to be in such a huge city, having grown up for most of my life in San Francisco. And I also was considering becoming a business person. By that time, my dad was at IBM already, and I was considering, you know, following his footsteps, so I thought maybe I'd go to Wharton as an undergrad at Penn. But honestly, at the end of the day, when the offers came in with the financial aid packages, you know, there's no way that we could have afforded it, either of those schools, without my parents going into a lot of debt, and they wouldn't let me take out debt. So I decided to go to Berkeley. It was a neighborhood school. I'd gone to Lowell, which is pretty much a feeder for Berkeley, and my sister was already there, so it was kind of a natural home school.
Right, and so you started in the engineering school, right?
Yes, I did.
So how did that go?
It didn't go well.
What did you talk a little about that experience and what it taught you in ways that are maybe not academic?
So, yes, I went in as an industrial engineer major, and I absolutely hated it. It kicked my ass. You know, like I said, I was a nerd. I went to Lowell. I'd never gotten anything, you know, below an A. And so, and then I got there in my first semester. It was all physics, chemistry, statistics, and math courses. And except for math, I just was horrible at the rest, to be honest. So I lost my Regents and Chancellor scholarship after that first semester because you have to maintain some GPA, which I didn't. And I was miserable. I mean, I had zero time. I remember my sister, who was dating her boyfriend, who's now my brother-in-law at the time, had invited me to go to Shakespeare in the park. It, you know, now it's in Orinda, but it used to be in Berkeley. And so I had like five problem sets due a week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And in order to go on a Wednesday night to Shakespeare, it felt like I had to move heaven and earth as an 18-year-old just to get one problem set done, two of them done on the Tuesday instead of the Wednesday. So I had no life. I had no time for electives, and I was just miserable. So I dropped out. And, you know, I did so with some trepidation, like, well, now you're one of those majorless people. You're undeclared, and what are you going to do with your life? And so I had taken some courses in history in this one semester when I was still deciding whether or not to continue with engineering, and it just completely opened up my mind and my eyes. You know, I ended up doing my honors thesis in my senior year on anti-miscegenation laws, and I studied civil rights, American civil rights history, and it was just like a whole new world had opened up to me. And so it was a really wonderful failure, if you can call it that, you know, to have sort of had engineering kick my butt, been really miserable, you know, didn't like getting B's and C's, and made a 180-degree turn. And that happened to me one other time, I will say, although the circumstances were a little bit different. But another so-called failure when I was a dropout was fast forward many years. I was already working here for former President Dick Atkinson, and he kept encouraging me to go back and get my PhD. So I did, but I was still working full-time here. And so I went for 3 years to get a PhD at Berkeley. I did all the coursework. You know, I'd gone through my first-year oral exams. I was preparing for my prospectus. And I just realized, oh, my God, what are you doing? You're miserable once again. And it wasn't clear to me what the PhD was for. You know, it wasn't like I had identified a job I wanted in the university or somewhere else in academia that I knew required a PhD. It was just kind of doing it, honestly, to, like, collect initials. So I dropped out once again. And the other thing about this that's interesting that showed me a lot about myself is that I really crave connection in everything I do, connection with other people. You know, the and I'm not saying this about all PhD programs, but in my particular case, especially since I was working full-time, so I was just rushing to campus and then coming back here for work, I really was pretty isolated in studying higher education policy at the time at the Berkeley Ed School. And so I did not feel connection with any of the folks there. And once again, I didn't love it, and so I was bound to fail.
So you've mentioned several times failure, you know, sometimes in air quotes. Mm-hmm. Aren't we really talking about expectations?
Yeah.
And I think from that we can make a leap to, you know, being stereotyped or pigeonholed, mm-hmm. you know, whether it's you or your family or sort of mm-hmm. society at large. I mean, did you ever experience that? And in what way and by whom?
Great question. So the first time I experienced it, actually, is when I was trying to decide whether or not to leave the engineering school at Berkeley. It was my sophomore year, and go into letters and science, which is the general college there. So I met with an L&S counselor, and I'll never forget, I didn't understand this. So the L&S counselor, probably trying to do his best, said two things to me, one of which was pigeonholing, I feel. One was, he said, I think you should take time off and do a year in community college. I have no idea why you would have someone leave, you know, a four-year, like, best, you know, public university to go to a community college. I mean, I really wasn't flunking by that time. I was getting B's. I just was miserable. So that was odd. But the second thing he said to me was, he just kept pushing on me that, you know, a lot of students, they feel all this pressure from their parents, and, you know, I'm sure your parents push you to do this, and nothing could be further from the truth. I mean,
because you're Asian.
Because I'm Asian, absolutely, and that's why I have to be an engineer. And my parents were not like that. I mean, you know, my mom is the farthest thing from Tiger Mom. She barely knew if we, like, did our homework, honestly. She's too busy working and keeping things together. And so so that felt weird to me. You know, it was the, kind of the first time I really felt pigeonholed because of my ethnicity. A second time that I can think of is when a former boss of mine, who happens to be an older white man, gave me some really valuable feedback at our performance meeting. He said, you know, you really need to exercise your voice more, which I thought was really critical. It was constructive and true, and I needed to hear it. And then he said, I think it's something cultural. You know, it must be a cultural thing that you don't speak as much. And so, you know, that was kind of like the backhanded, you know, slap, whatever it was, praise, slash, not. And so so I do think that I don't know if pigeonholing is the right word, but I do think that people have expectations of me to act like the affable model minority that a lot of Asians mm-hmm. are expected to. I want to just tell a really brief story about that particular notion, because since then, I think that that really did make me feel, sort of doubt my own leadership skills and abilities and style, because, and this really was, you know, front and center at Princeton. I mean, you can imagine, like, it was me in a room full of, like, debating society captains, right? And so it's not just the first thought that comes in your head, but it's, like, the first 10 thoughts. And so there was a lot of, you know, having to fight your way into a conversation, which isn't really my style. So for many years, I would say, I've questioned sort of that L word, leadership. But actually, just a few weeks ago, I was in my annual performance meeting with my current boss, Julie, and one of the things that she noted and praised me for was my leadership style, which she called quiet yet effective. And it was really validating for me because, you know, to have someone recognize that there are all these different leadership styles, not just what's in the textbooks, and that there are a lot of different things that can be effective. And I think she said something like, you know, you tend to bring people along and value them rather than sort of just push things on them. And so it was really interesting how different her perception of me was from my self-perception. My best friend, Leanna, always says to me whenever I'm in self-doubt, and she says, your eyes are broken, but you can borrow mine until they're working. So sometimes my eyes are broken, and sometimes it is because of people pigeonholing you.
So you're talking about, you know, you bring people along. How about others? Have they brought you along? Have you had any mentors?
Oh, my God, have I had any mentors? I've had so many mentors. I've been so lucky. I don't know how you make it in any business. And there he is. I've been waiting for you, Carlos.
No pressure.
I don't know how you make it. Yeah, no pressure. I don't know how you make it without mentors, honestly. I will say, and, you know, the thing about mentors is a lot of them are really they don't like to be called mentors or think of themselves as mentors, but that's really what they are to you. Nina Robinson is one of my mentors who's here today. My first job at UC was being Nina's secretary at Berkeley, and I also supported another man, Pat Hayashi, that many of you know, who was also a mentor for me for many years. And it's funny how we all end up at OP after a stint on the campus. And I remember vividly that when I was applying to graduate schools, and that only came about because of being the administrative assistant in that office, I swear, I couldn't decide. I had whittled it down to two choices. One was Berkeley, GSPP, and the other was the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton. And I remember Nina saying to me, she said, go to Princeton. You've done Berkeley. And then she said, go to the East Coast while your parents are still young and healthy. And, you know, that really spoke to me because I wasn't going to make that decision based on the school's reputations or their faculties. I mean, they were both really, you know, top schools or any of those other sort of, you know, quantitative data points. She knew what would motivate me is, you know, sort of to talk about my connection with my family. And she was absolutely right. And then when I was leaving, she threw a fabulous farewell party for me and said to me at her doorstep on her old house on Milvia Street, she said, don't just dip your toe in, jump in with both feet. And I remember that, too, because I am kind of a fear-based person, and she knew that about me and sensed it in my going 3,000 miles away, having never lived away from my family. And so that was really important to me, is her saying that. I'll just share one other anecdote from Pat Hayashi, my former boss, who is the reason why I'm at OP. And he was a champion, and he always had all these, Jocelyn knows, he has all these, like, great, you know, tidbits and stories. So my first day, November 13th, 2000, in OP, in the president's executive office, working for who I had not met yet, Dick Atkinson, the former president. And those of you who are around, you know Dick was, he's older, he's very distinguished, he has ADD and Tourette's, not diagnosed by me. And a lot of people felt a lot of, like, intimidation from him. You know, he was like the quintessential scholar and former chancellor, all of those things. And he's a little far removed. So I hadn't met the man yet, but I was coming to be his special assistant, really reporting to Pat. So the first thing that happened was Pat called me into his office, and we're chatting, and he said, what are you going to call him? And I said, what do you mean, what am I going to call him? He said, are you going to call him President Atkinson? Are you going to call him, you know, sir? Dr. Atkinson, what are you going to call him? And I said, I hadn't thought about it. What should I call him? And, of course, Pat, this was like Pat's sort of a, he's an orator himself, so he uses all these, like, tactics of persuasion. So first he asks you this innocent question when he already, of course, has the answer, right? So he says, you need to call him Dick. First of all, in my generation, even though I'm older than many of you in the room, there aren't a lot of Dicks. You know?
Well, yes, there are. But
boom, boom. We're going to be here all week. So, I mean, you know, Richard, yes, but I really did not know anyone my age who went by Dick. And so, at least not formally, you know. And so I said, oh, okay. And he said, you know, many people in this building call him President Atkinson or Dr. Atkinson, but you need to establish that you are here to work with him and that you are a colleague of his, not a subordinate, even though I was, of course, a subordinate. And then Pat said, it's much easier to establish a pattern than to break one. So you got to start that on day one. And I did, and I called him Dick until after he retired, when he, one day his new secretary at San Diego said to me, he would like you to start calling him Richard. So I guess he doesn't want to be a dick either. And then finally, Diane, I mean, you know, mentors, role models, there's a lot of, I have a lot of labels for people like that, but I remember something that you shared with me, actually, not that long ago. You said to me, you apologize too much in your emails. Remember that?
Mm.
Yeah. And, you know, I would apologize for things that were actually other people's fault. Like, I would say, Like, I would, you know, I'm really good at, like, herding cats and bugging you if you haven't done something. And so I would do some email and say, you know, thanks for those of you who've already met the deadline, and we need to hear from the rest of you, edits are due, blah, 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 blah. Sorry for the short turnaround. And it wasn't a short turnaround. It was only a short turnaround because they hadn't done their work. So I just remember one day Diane, I don't know if it was over drinks or if it was in the office, saying to me, you shouldn't apologize, you know, for things that aren't like, that you don't need to apologize for. And that really stuck with me. And actually to this day, if I'm not moving 100 miles per hour, I do tend to go back to my emails and look to make sure that I'm not over-apologizing. So.
So I think many of us in the room, or the reason aside from that we really like you and admire you, are wondering how you got here. I mean, if you look on a spreadsheet, you know, it's a steady upward climb. But has it really been that way? I mean, can you talk about some of the zigs and zags?
Oh, yeah. All I did was zig and zag. I graduated during the recession, and so I went to work as an office manager in Walnut Creek for a tiny startup before there were startups. And they sold this thing called a print server, which is a box that connects various computers to a printer so that you can all print to one printer. And so, I mean, they never made it. That poor company went out of business. But so anyways, needless to say, it wasn't very exciting to be their office manager, but I didn't really have a choice. So one of my other role models, who's not here today, but is the next speaker, Yvette Goulon. Yvette was actually my first UC boss because I couldn't quite leave the university even though I had a full-time day job. So I would go back to campus at night and tutor the student athletes there. And Yvette was running that program at the time. And so, you know, I saw in her a very smart, capable woman, well-educated, who had a thriving career at the university. At that time, it was on campus. So, anyway, the company went under, and I was left, you know, I mean, I was kind of relieved because I dreaded going to work every day, but I also had to pay a mortgage, so I had to apply. So I applied for mostly jobs at the campus. This is all I knew at the time. And thankfully, Nina and Pat interviewed me, and they ended up hiring me. I think I was probably an AA3 at the time. And that job really changed my life. And so I really did start, I mean, I did kind of work my way up, although I zigged and zagged along the way. But if it wasn't for that particular position, I wouldn't have gone to graduate school, nor would I have known that there was this thing called public policy in higher education. So that that office was really special to me because it also began my love affair with policy in higher ed. So I spent a little bit of time in the governor's office after I graduated from grad school, and then Pat hired me to come back here to OP. And, you know, it was a really fascinating time when the president was trying to eliminate the SAT in college admission. So that was a wild ride. We also sold NINA to OP from the campus shortly thereafter. And then talk about zigging and zagging. Fast forward many years to executive compensation crisis and scandal that many of you remember. It was about 10 years ago now, and it was, you know, a real failure. I mean, in the sense that people blamed us, OP, for not managing it well. Campuses were mad at OP. Nothing's changed, right? There was a lot of infighting. Staff were leaking things left and right to the newspapers. Tanya Shevitz of the Chronicle won an award for her reporting on this. We were called on the carpet in legislative hearings. And at that time, unlike now, the regions completely lost confidence in the president and in the office of the president. So it was also personally so hard to come to work every day. It was demoralizing to see this institution that you love and that you work really hard for be, you know, dragged through the mud and having cartoons of greedy senior leaders, et cetera. Really, really hard time. I also want to say something in a minute about my personal life at the time. And yet that experience alone, I think, was probably the seminal UC experience for me in the sense that, you know, I managed issues and I raised my hand. I tell a lot of people, I say this to my team too, but you know, when people, younger people come and do informational interviews with you and they say, oh, what career advice do you have? I always, especially if they're starting out here at OP, I always tell them, raise your hand. You know, raise your hand for interesting assignments and things that seem really hairy and unattractive, but you'll grow the most from those things. And that's really what I did during that time. I also practiced influence without authority, which is something that many of us have to do, you know, because most of us don't get to just say, because I say so. And I got a lot of practice with under Atkinson with that, and so that really came in handy during that comp. Anyways, to wrap it up, you know, that experience, which seemed like a failure, really, and I thought I might lose my job because people around me were being moved and pushed out and, you know, farmed out to other buildings. But instead, I mean, I did get moved, but I was told it was to protect me. And so I got to lobby for us, for UC in Sacramento at that time, and it was a great experience. And without both of those experiences, there would be no impact, and I would definitely not have been qualified to be one of the people that they, you know, to be the one selected. I just want to say one other thing about that time period, because you talk about zigging and zagging, and, you know, I was a pretty chubby kid, but it got a lot worse during that period. I mean, I've just always had weight issues. And during that period, I worked 60 to 80, many of us did, worked 60 to 80 hours a week. I lived in Concord, and that drive, as many of you know, is hell. I lived out near Clayton. And so I would leave here often at 11 o'clock at night and go directly to the Jack in the Box drive-thru on my way home. I would nap at all the red lights because I had to go down Ignacio Valley Road, and any of you who knows Ignacio, it's 9 miles of red lights. So I had a lot of napping time. And one of the people that I staffed, Nina and I both did actually, on this independent task force that the regions put together was Bob Hertzberg, who's now in the state senate, but at the time he was independent. He had been former assembly speaker, and he was getting his business off the ground in Wales. So we'd have conference calls at 2:30 in the morning. So this whole, I mean, I'm you know, painting this picture for you of how I got to be 275 pounds during that period. So there was, I don't want to call it a failure, but a major setback in my health. I also had a scare during that time. I thought I might have MS because I lost the ability, the dexterity in my hands. I couldn't hold pens or chopsticks. So anyways, it was really a rough time. But because of it, on the personal side, I really did realize that I couldn't lose my life to work. And so I'm always still looking for that balance, but that's kind of the zigging and zagging, both professionally and personally.
And out of that time of really intense turmoil,
yeah.
I mean, founded Impact. I mean,
yeah.
You type
well,
the next.
It was founded.
the next step,
uh-huh.
And, you know, which is a huge deal.
Yeah.
And how did people support you, or did they say you were out of your mind, or who the hell are you to lead something like
all
that?
All of the above, completely all of the above. Impact came out of the very painful restructuring that OP underwent in 2007-08. Again, I was part of the small group led by Nina, actually, that formulated Impact, but I was not really that involved because I was in Sacramento doing the ledge work. And I remember in my interview, which was all with people I knew, including my boss at the time. Anyways, they said, well, why are you interested in this job? And I had the corniest line, but it was true. I said, well, you know, little boys grow up to want to be firefighters, and little girls grow up and they want to be princesses. I've always wanted to be an issues manager.
Really
lame and totally not true, but that's how I felt. And so I was lucky enough to get the job and moved back to the Bay Area, left SGR, and then so I had lost 130 pounds by then, and I had hired this amazing team, several of whom are still with me today, and I had a huge office on the 11th floor, which I don't miss at all, and I'll tell you why. And, you know, I had my dream job, and so it seemed like up, up, up. But there were a lot of supporters in those days. I mean, the sort of the restructuring people were supporters. Other senior leaders were very open. I remember having lunch with Jack Stobo early on, and he just said, you know, how can I help you in this new role? So, and I wouldn't call them detractors, but the one thing that none of us who were involved in restructuring really thought about, well, not, I shouldn't say none of us, I hadn't thought about, was, you know, we have a new president coming on board, and so he and whoever he brings may or may not feel the need for all these new units. And I do not believe that President Udall, although I've never had a conversation with him, felt there was a need for an issues management unit. And certainly he brought somebody with him to be the Associate Vice President overseeing IMPACT and, at the time, IRAP, which was just IR. And she certainly didn't feel there was a need. And she also, I think, we had a difference of opinion in terms of what policy analysis was, because she really felt that policy analysis was the same thing as data analysis. I will share, I know I'm being recorded, darn it, but I will share with you that during that time, the initial days of IMPACT, I was miserable. For about 2.5 years, I met every single morning with my boss, and 3 days out of five, I run downstairs, she was on 12, I run to my office on 11, and just bawled, just cry my eyes out, because I felt so not valued and also underutilized and sort of at wit's end, because I was like, what am I supposed to be doing? What am I doing wrong? So, and I felt really badly for my team, this wonderful, collection of talented professionals who were hired to do a much broader scope of work than we were allowed to do in the first few years. So what did I learn from that experience? So many things. I have a spiritual mentor also. Her name is Susie. And she told me, I shared this with her during that time, and she said, Jenny, you have to think of every single person in your life as either an angel or a teacher. I thought she was going to say devil. She's a devil. And she said, and sometimes they're both. And what she meant by that, of course, is there's something to be learned here. And what I learned was, with a little bit of distance, I have to say, during the time, it was very hard for me to pull out of that misery. But what I learned was just, it was like a mirror. I often feel insecure in various areas of my life. But how that insecurity is translated into how you treat or behave with other people is something that I saw, And then the other thing I learned was just how resilient I am, as overused as that word is. But the team and I got through that time together, and, thankfully the new administration under President Napolitano's leadership does see a value in the work that we do, and so we've been very gainfully employed and utilized for the last few years. The other thing I realized was just having compassion for other people. Again, it was really hard for me at the time. I'm not going to be, try to say that I'm a bigger person than I really am. Hard for me at the time to have compassion, but with some distance, and once I was no longer reporting to that person, I realized, she must have been scared to death and had her back up against the wall. She was coming into UC completely new, and after a period of, turmoil where the Board of Regents had no confidence in the staff, et cetera, et cetera. So I recently, actually, over the weekend, trying to get inspired for this talk, I rewatched some of the Brené Brown TED Talks, and she said, I quote her, she said, blame is a way to discharge pain and discomfort. And that kind of, describes a lot of what's going on.
So I'll end my questions with sort of wrapping up what I see as a theme here, which is about balance, work and life in general between the sweet Jenny and the ain't nothing going to stop me, get out of my goddamn way, Jenny. And how it's had an effect on you personally. So you're in your 40s. Family is usually important to you. You're not married. You don't have any children. Can you talk a little bit about that? Was that intentional or what's going on there?
Definitely not intentional. I will say that when I think back to the people I could have married, somebody is looking out for me. Honestly, growing up, I was like the kid person, since 9 years old, all kids loved me, and I loved all kids, and back then there weren't rules about how old you had to be to babysit. I babysat, and my cousin's in the audience, Irene, and my sister was so not into kids. I don't even know if she's still into kids now. She's only into her own kid and Irene's kid at this point, but I do have a nephew who's 10. Anyway, and so, I think the whole family thought, I would be married with tons of kids, and she would probably get married, but not, and she also dated a lot, and I didn't. And so, it's really interesting. So, she's married, and she has one son. And, I think about this because it's the dreaded first date question when the man says to you, so how come you're still single? And I want to say, because of people like you. No. I do think about this. You know, I think I just sacrifice a lot. And, again, I mean this in a way that's completely on me, you know, about setting boundaries and not finding balance. I did give a lot to my career for most of those years. And it just kind of flew, you know, you think you're 25 one day, and the next day you wake up and you're 45. So that's part of it. And then I just also think I wasn't ready to be a good partner in a marriage until probably very recently. You know, I wasn't ready physically. I wasn't ready emotionally, spiritually. And, you know, you really, really have to work on yourself before you can be a really great partner to someone else. And so now I'm ready. I don't know about the kids part, but, you know, I do have a new boyfriend, and we'll see where it goes. It's very new. But and also, Diane, if I were married with kids, you and I wouldn't be able to go traveling together, right? Of all our adventures.
Yeah.
So that's why I stayed single for you.
Yeah. I really appreciate that. So if anybody has any questions for Jenny, I can let you. Do you need the mic?
I can repeat my question.
Okay.
Thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you, Marianne.
About your career. What's next?
What's
on
next your list?
What, you got a lot of, you know, got a lot of space ahead of you. What,
yeah.
What do
you mean career or in general?
Whatever.
Well, honestly, getting through my mom's chemo is presently what's next for my family and me, and hoping that, you know, we have a lot more time with her, and so that's a big part of, you know, what I face every day or you know, think about, I should say. And then I really want to run another marathon. I mean, that's what I think about. I'm not in any shape to do that right now, so that would be pretty fabulous. One other thing, she's not here either, but, you know, there are people along the way who say or do things that really mean something. And when I first, I think I was still in the process of losing weight, and I had started running for the first time in my life at age, like, 38. And Patricia Osorio Ode, who many of you know, is a ultra marathoner. She's run 200-mile races. And I knew she was a runner. And we've known each other for a very long time. And she said to me, if you can run a mile, you can run a marathon. And she gave me that little mustard seed of hope in the beginning. She also gave me all of her back issues of runner's world. So I was like this crazy woman. Atkinson went back to La Jolla, and he didn't want his elliptical. Gym quality pre-core elliptical machine. So he gave it to me. So in my little suburban house in Concord, I'm like losing weight, and I'm on the elliptical, and I'm reading Runner's World and crying my eyes out at these runner stories, which now I'm like, psh, I'm so jaded now, right? But anyways, you know, Patricia in her magazines and me in that mode really inspired me. I've run two marathons, and I want to do another one. But that's one of those work-life balance things that it's really hard to, you know, find the time to do the training and put in the work. So.
And also, I will add, for those of you who don't know, Jenny lost a tremendous amount of weight and went on Oprah, and
yes,
there is a picture of her. It's hot.
Hot pink.
Hot pink.
Dolce & Gabbana.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Any other questions, Jenny?
Jocelyn.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jenny for over 20 years. I can see her. Stood out for me during our talk today is to practice influence without authority.
Yeah.
Can you suggest any resources or workshops that the Impact Talk can bring to OP?
Oh, no. I didn't learn it through a workshop.
More from your experience?
Yeah, I think, you know, for me, if I think about it, it's, I mean, it goes back to Diane's point about, you know, how do I balance sort of the nice Jenny with the person that has to get stuff done. And a lot of that is, unfortunately, or fortunately, just comes through time spent together and relationships. You know, you go through battles and wars together, and, you know, people know what you're about and that you're willing to also put in the work. I think it's just demonstrating that you yourself is someone who may not have the authority and title, but if you're asking to do something or if you're trying to rally or convene a group of people to move in a certain direction, they have to have confidence in that direction, right? And so for me, it always came down to relationships. I have to think a little bit more about how to actually bring that to a group like PacSoft. And I want to thank you, Jocelyn, because I bounced ideas off of Jocelyn last week in a panic about what to talk about today. She was really helpful, as always.
Thank you.
Have a question?
I was just going to ask what led you to your appearance on Oprah?
Well, she's never asked. No, I'm kidding. It was my weight loss, you know. People have heard the story, but it was pretty amazing. In 2011, it's Cesar Chavez holiday, end of March, I remember, because I was home napping on my couch. It wasn't that. I'll get to that. But anyways, I go on the website, because my mom is the biggest Barbara Streisand fan, okay? She's a fanatic, you know. Of course, for her, it's always Hubba and the Pebble and the Way We Were, right? So I watch, like, this episode where it's a whole hour of Oprah interviewing Babs, and Robert Redford comes on as a surprise guest. And I was like, oh, my God, I have to record this for my mom. My sister lives next door to my parents, and my parents don't even know what a DVR is. So my sister, of course, I said, record this thing for mom. And it was, like, March, and so I somehow knew because of my former Gilligan Island days, of course, that like February and May were sweeps weeks, but like in March they rerun things all the time. So I went on the Oprah website for the first time in my life, even though I'd watched her growing up, and in the corner it says, have you recently lost 100 pounds or more and would like to be on the Oprah show? And I was like, why, yes. So long story short, I, you know, submit something very last minute. My boyfriend at the time had to like size the picture, the before and after pictures just right, and like they allowed like no pixel or whatever it was. And so I send it in, and I get a call that afternoon. That's when I was napping on the couch. And at the time, my iPhone didn't really work at home because AT&T hadn't put up enough towers yet. But I saw a Chicago, you know, number, and I was like, this is weird. So I answered it. Usually I just think telemarketer. And it was her senior producer saying, would you like to be on the show? Well, he said, would you like to come to the show? We're going to have 100, this was her final season, 100 fans who had each lost 100 pounds or more in the audience. And I was like, come to the show to be in the audience? Mm. So I told my, you know, my closest friend from grad school, and she's like, we have to go. I'll go with you. So we go. And I had never been to Chicago. And so for me, I was like, I'm going to tack on a few days before the taping because I really want to see the city. And she couldn't come with me. So I went early. Thank God. I land in O'Hare, and there's a text from him, Brad, somebody or other, and he said, we'd actually like you in the opening act. Can you be at Harpo Studios at 11 a.m. tomorrow? And I had just landed that evening, the evening before. And I was like, I could be anywhere Miss Winfrey needs me to be. So that's what. I didn't have a speaking role, but I was in the opening number with her. So, yeah.
You didn't call it over? Get that level of...
I didn't really call her, and she doesn't even rehearse. She's such a pro, consummate pro. She just came on, did it, and left. And the same day, they take two shows a day. The same day, they were taping a show with the Obamas, and so my best friend who had flown out with me, poor woman, she was in the rain for 3 hours. She had to get through Chicago PD line, Oprah security line, and then Secret Service line. And they took even her pen. So, anyways, it was a really great experience. That's how I got at Oprah for the weight loss. Yeah.
One last question. Anybody? Going once, going twice? Well,
Karen.
That was like me. Jenny, just a couple of thoughts. What do you think could OP or the university have done to sort of help progression maybe with a few less all-nighters, a little more work-life balance, maybe a few more tools in the toolkit you have to make in the garage all by yourself?
I didn't do it alone, first of all, let me say that. I don't know, Garrett. We were under such assault at the time. It was just like, you know, leaks in the boat, and you couldn't cover them up quickly enough. Well, for one thing, you could reimburse my mileage on the weekends. Rachel's laughing. new casual Fridays. Right, in my dream, exactly. No, I'm teasing, but... gosh, I don't know, Garen. You know, I mean, one thing that worked, it didn't take away from the hours, but, and we've used this model a lot now under the new administration, is we had a strike team that would meet, you know, I think our strike team actually met weekly, Nina?
Are you talking about comp?
Comp strike team, yeah. But we had a call every single day. So
yeah.
That every
calls
single,
is what I
so that all the various groups, you know, compensation, OGC, you know, everyone, media, everyone was on the same page every single day. I mean, I think, I don't know how else there is to manage a crisis of that kind of magnitude and intensity. So those helped. It's just hard to say because I think when there's infighting, like when campuses are pitted against OP and vice versa, it's just, it's so hard, you know. What else could we have done? Well, we had ice cream and bourbon at our strike team meetings. I thought that helped.
in the table.
Yeah, right, in the table. You know, before we close, I want to say, because it's June, I wanted to just say thank you and honor all the women who are retiring this month after so many decades of service. Debbie Obley, Cheryl Bennett, who Julie and I are going to miss greatly, as well as a lot of you. Linda Kane, Karen Tomagen, Cecile Cutita, Patty Missouri. I'm sure I'm missing a lot of people. Those are the ones I know about. But we're losing a lot of women we admire this month and every year we do. So I just wanted to thank them, even though they're not here, for everything that they've done for all of us. Thank you for spending your lunch hour here.
Well, thank you, Jenny.
Well, thank you, Ms. Diane. You earned it.